and Schofield, had asked Viola to have a word with Teddy about his belligerent behaviour.
"But we've lost nearly 90% of the Watervale population in 30 years, he protested to Viola. "That's enough to make anyone feel belligerent, although not a patch on how annoyed the Watervales must feel, I imagine."
"You don't know what you've got till it's gone," Bertie said, as the song goes.
Teddy didn't know what song, but he understood the sentiment.
"Don't be silly," Viola said. "And I think you're a bit old to be embracing causes."
Wildlife took its chances in his daughter's harsh Darwinian universe.
"All this obsession with ecology isn't doing you any good," Viola said. "You're too old to be getting so worked up."
Ecology, Teddy thought.
"Nature," he said. "We used to call it nature."
At the time of this flying visit to Fanning Court, Viola was already campaigning for Teddy to move to a nursing home. She had brought a handful of leaflets with her. He had taken a fall a couple of days ago, not a bad one. His legs had given way, and he had gone down like a collapsed concertina.
"Stuck on my bloody arse," he said gruffly to Anne Schofield when she came in.
Yes, he had been near one of the red cords, and yes, he had pulled it.
"Language, please,"
she reprimanded, as if he were a delinquent child. When only yesterday he had overheard her, when she thought she was alone in the laundry room, addressing a truculent door on a washing machine with the words,
"Why don't you behave, you little fucking shit?"
An invocation made all the more scrappy somehow by her Birmingham accent. He had managed, with minimal help from the fat controller,
"Against health and safety regulations, I have to call the paramedics,"
to get onto his knees, and from there onto the sofa, and was perfectly fine apart from a couple of bruises. But this was proof positive to Viola that he couldn't manage independent living. She had harried him out of his house and into Fanning Court. Now she was trying to shuck him out of here and into a place called Poplar Hill. He imagined she wouldn't be satisfied until she badgered him into his coffin. She fanned out the nursing home leaflets, the one for Poplar Hill placed significantly on top of the pile, and said,
"At least take a look."
He gave them a cursory glance. Photographs of happy, smiling people with full heads of grey hair, and, as he pointed out to her, not a hint of shit and piss and dementia.
"Your language is terrible these days," Viola said primly. "What's happening to you?" "I'll be dead soon," he said. "It's making me bullshit." "Don't be silly."
She was dressed very smartly, he noticed.
"I'm on my way somewhere." "Somewhere?"
She had always hated explaining. It was part of her closed-off character. He had passed her in the street once, when she was a teenager. She was with friends from school, and she had looked right through him when she passed. A son called Hugh would never have done such a thing.
"Somewhere?"
he repeated, trying to needle her into elaboration.
"They're making a movie out of one of my novels. I've got a meeting with the execs."
The offhand but deliberate way she said the words "movie" and "execs" made them sound like she was indifferent when she clearly wasn't. There had been a film of her second novel, The Children of Adam. It had been an inferior sort of film. British. Viola had given him a DVD. Not that the book was much cop to begin with. Not that he would ever have said that to her. He had found it
very good,
he told her.
"Just very good?"
she frowned. Good Lord, he thought, wasn't that enough? He would have been more than pleased with a very good if he had ever finished his attempt at a novel. What had it been called? Something about sleeping and quiet breathing. It was a quote from Keats, that much he remembered. But which poem? He could sense the clouds gathering in his brain. Perhaps Viola was right. Perhaps it was time to give up, check into God's waiting room. Her first novel, Sparrows at Dawn, what a terrible title, had been about a clever, or annoyingly arrogant, young girl being brought up by her father. It was clearly meant to be autobiographical,
a message of some sort to him from Viola. The girl was relentlessly badly done by, and the father was a doltish martinet. Not what Sylvie would have called art.
"Which one?"
he asked, gathering his thoughts, pushing the clouds out of the way.
"Which novel are they making into a film?"
"The End of Twilight."
And then, impatiently, when she caught him looking blankly at her,
"It's the one about the mother who has to give up her baby."
"Wishful thinking on her part," Bertie said. She made a show of looking at the heavy gold watch on her wrist.
"Rolex. It's an investment, really."
He was unsure whether this ostentatious gesture was meant to remind him of her busy life or her success. Both, he supposed. She was a more streamlined version of herself these days, dieted and coiffed, her hair 10 different shades of blonde that Teddy had never seen before. No more henna, no more droopy clothing. All the velvets and sequins she'd held on to into middle age had gone, and now, whenever he saw her, she was dressed in tailored suits and neutral colours.
"The Children of Adam changed my life,"
he read in a copy of Woman's Weekly, left in the communal lounge, that he had been idly leafing through, looking for recipes promised on the cover for cheap and easy suppers. Prize-winning author Viola Romaine talks about her best-selling early novel. "It's never too late to pursue your dream," she tells us in this exclusive interview, and so on.
"I have to go,"
she said, standing up abruptly, swinging her handbag on its heavy gilt chain.
"You have to start considering a nursing home, Dad. Care home, that's what they're called these days. Money's not an issue. I'll help out, of course. This one here..."
She tapped the Poplar Hill brochure with a pink-varnished fingernail.
"It's supposed to be excellent. Think about it. Think where you would like to go."
Fox Corner, he thought. "That's where I'd like to go." Teddy didn't fight Nancy's sudden desire to move, and when the job came up on the Yorkshire Evening Press, he applied, and a few weeks later they moved to York. It was swift, like an incision. Nancy easily found part-time work in the maths department at the Mount, a Quaker school, and returned to the relief of educating clever, well-behaved girls. Viola took up a place in the junior school. Nancy liked the Society of Friends, she said. It was the nearest Christianity could get to agnosticism. Teddy knew York from the war. Then it had been a mysterious maze of dark, narrow streets and snickets. It had been a place to go drinking and dancing, carousing in Betty's bar, or shuffling girls around the De Grey rooms, a place of fumbled kisses with willing girls in the tenebrous blackout. In the light of peace, York was a less veiled city, its history on show everywhere. He liked it more in the daylight, yet it remained a place of secrets, as if whenever one layer had been unearthed, another one was waiting to be discovered. One's own life seemed puny against the background of so much history. It was a strange comfort to think of how many had gone before, how many had been forgotten. It was the natural order of things. The house they bought, a solid semi in the suburbs, wasn't the kind that Teddy had ever imagined living in. Unlike Mouse Cottage and Aswick, it had no name, only a number, which suited its bland anonymity. No character at all. The new Nancy, the one who didn't go about truffling primroses, embraced it. Sensible and practical, she called it. They installed central heating, fitted carpets, and modernized both kitchen and bathroom. It had no aesthetic virtues whatsoever in Teddy's eyes. Sylvie would have been appalled, but she had already been dead for 2 years by then, felled by a stroke while she was pruning her roses. They always used the possessive pronoun. The roses belonged to no one but their mother. Now they didn't even exist.
"Dug up,"
according to Pamela, by the new owners of Fox Corner.
"The trick, I suppose," Ursula said, "is not to mind."
But he did, and so did she. For months after they moved to York, Teddy would wake in the morning and feel a pang of sorrow
as he listened to a subdued suburban dawn chorus competing with the low rumble of traffic from somewhere. The A64, he guessed. He missed having a wild green world on his doorstep. No rabbits or pheasants or badgers in York, only peacocks in the museum gardens. He didn't see another fox until the mangy urban species started raiding the bins around the back of Fanning Court. Teddy sneaked leftovers out to them, covert charity that left Anne Schofield reeling with horror. They were vermin, she said.
She's the vermin, Bertie said.
Sometimes Bertie reminded him of Sylvie, the best of her at any rate. The new house had a generous back garden, and he bought a Reader's Digest book on gardening. The garden, as far as Teddy could see, was nature tamed and constrained by artifice. His wings had been clipped, like Tweety, the blue budgerigar that Viola had insisted on for her birthday.
"Robin Redbreast in a cage,"
Teddy murmured when Nancy returned home from the pet shop with the bird.
I know," she said. "Puts all heaven in a rage. But budgerigars are bred for captivity. It's a shame, but they don't know anything else."
"That must be a great consolation to them," Teddy said.
Their other little POW, the hapless Goldie, did not survive the house move. In Blake's litany of wrongdoing, there was nothing about a goldfish in a bowl, but he would surely not have approved. Viola was upset at the sight of the pale, floating corpse, and Teddy rooted out his old goldfish club badge and showed it to her.
"Imagine him with wings," he advised, "rising up to heaven."
Tweety proved to be a misnamed bird, never uttering a single chirp in his whole short life, most of which he spent either pecking listlessly at his cuttlefish bone or paddling from one foot to another on his wooden perch. Better, perhaps, Teddy thought, in a fleeting moment of identification with the morose creature, to be Icarus and embrace the fall.
"Away. Again," he said,
making an effort to sound casual.
"Yes, again,"
she said lightly.
"That's all right with you, isn't it?"
"Yes, of course," Teddy said. "It's just..."
He hesitated, not sure how to give voice to his misgivings. This will be the third time Nancy had been away in as many months, each time to visit one of her sisters. Firstly, she had gone down to Dorset to help Gertie move house, and this was quickly followed by a trip to the lakes with Millie.
Wordsworth's cottage and so on.
Millie was leading a rather rackety life in Brighton, and was between husbands at the moment.
"She probably needs a sympathetic ear," Nancy said.
Nancy claimed to be a homebody, not even keen on decamping for their annual seaside holiday. Every summer, the three of them,
the family triumvirate, as Nancy called it,
according Viola equal power with her parents, Teddy noted, although really they were not so much a triumvirate as a tiny tyrant and her two dedicated attendants, took a dutiful holiday on the East Coast. Bridlington, Scarborough, Filey. This was for Viola's benefit, rather than their own.
"Bucket and spade," Nancy said.
That was all a small child needed, and persisted heroically in this belief, as the triumvirate sheltered, shivering, in the lee of hired windbreaks, or took refuge in damp and steamy tea shops, after eating the liver sausage sandwiches that their boarding-house landlady packed up for them every morning. It was less of a holiday and more of an endurance test.
"Can we go home yet?"
was Viola's constant refrain, echoed silently by Teddy. They stayed in boarding-houses from which their dog was exiled, and so it was at these times that Viola's stark status as an only child was most apparent. She wasn't very good at playing by herself, and even less so with others. A wind-whipped Yorkshire coast wasn't Teddy's idea of a holiday. The North Sea was the graveyard of many of the incorporeal dead at Runnymede, the seabed littered with the rich and strange. Two of the worst nights of his war had been spent helplessly floating on its uncharitable waves.
"Well... good luck to you, then."
When Viola was a bit older, Nancy said, they would go further afield. Wales, Cornwall.
Europe,
Teddy said. The solid blocks of colour, the hot slices of sunshine. Yet now Nancy was proposing a visit to B in London.
Just a couple of nights, taking a show, maybe an exhibition.
It was late, nearly bedtime, and she was still marking homework. Teddy could see columns of fractions that were meaningless to him.
Show me your workings, Nancy wrote in neat red pen,
and then paused and looked up at him. She always wore such a frank, guileless expression. It invited confession, promised absolution. He imagined her pupils adored her.
Well, anyway, Nancy said, I thought I would leave for London on Wednesday evening and be back on Friday. Viola will be at school while you're at work, and after school she can go home with her friend, Sheila, and wait for you to pick her up.
How detailed this scheme was, Teddy thought. Wouldn't it be easier for everyone if she simply visited B at the weekend?
You don't mind holding the fort, do you? And Viola will love spending some time alone with you.
Will she?
Teddy said, somewhat ruefully. Viola, nearly 9 now, still doted on her mother, while Teddy seemed to be merely a parental necessity.
I won't go if you don't want me to,
Nancy said. What a polite conversation this was, Teddy thought. What if he said,
No, don't go.
What would she say then? Instead, he said,
Don't be silly, why wouldn't I want you to? Of course you should go, no earthly reason why not. And I can reach you at B's if there are any problems. I'm sure you won't need to,
Nancy said, and added casually,
And we'll be out a lot, I expect.
When Nancy had been in the lakes, there had been no telephone in the cottage that Millie had rented. When she had helped Gertie move house, the new telephone had not yet been connected.
If there's a dreadful emergency, Nancy said breezily, or some terrible accident occurs...
It was tempting fate to refer to such things so glibly, Teddy thought. You can put out one of those announcements you hear on the radio. You know, the police are trying to contact whoever, believed to be in the Westmoreland area. Please get in touch, and so on. 40 years later, when he was living in Fanning Court, Viola gave him a mobile phone and said,
There, now you'll never be out of touch, if you have another accident.
She meant the broken hip. She never let him forget this mishap, as if it had exposed a great flaw in his character,
or get lost or something.
Lost?
He never learned how to use the phone. The buttons were too small, the instructions too complicated.
Old dog, new tricks, he said to Bertie. And anyway, why would I want to be in touch all the time?
There's nowhere for anyone to hide these days, she said.
In the imagination,
he offered.
Even there, Bertie said grimly, you're not safe. Good, Nancy said. I'll go on Wednesday then. That's settled.
She started stacking the homework jotters tidily on top of each other.
All finished. Why don't you heat up the milk for some cocoa?
She gave him a quizzical smile and said,
Is everything all right?
We don't have to bother with cocoa if you don't want.
No, he said. It's fine. I'll do it.
Show me your workings, Nancy, he thought. When Nancy had been unreachable in Dorset, helping Gertie to move house, Teddy had been surprised when the phone rang and it was Gertie herself, although her phone was supposedly not yet connected. A woman not given to preamble, she said,
You know that big oak sideboard in my dining room, the arts and crafts one that used to be in the dining room at Jackdaw's?
The one with copper hinges and the De Morgan tiles, Teddy said.
Clearly, he did know it.
That's the one. There's no room for it in this new house. No room for hardly anything, she added cheerfully.
And Teddy remembered how much he liked Gertie and why.
Anyway, she carried on. I know you've always admired it, and so I thought you might like to have it. I can stick it on a van, one of those part-load ones. It shouldn't cost too much.
Otherwise, I'm afraid it might have to go into a sale.
That's very kind of you. I'd love it. But, he added doubtfully, I'm not sure that we have room.
He thought wistfully of Aswick, and how handsome the sideboard would have looked in the big farmhouse kitchen. But here, within the blandly ordinary walls of the York semi, it would surely look quite out of place. He was surprised by a sudden pang of desire. It was a piece of furniture that he remembered well from the Shawcrosses' house. From the past.
What does Nancy say about it?
I've no idea, Gertie said.
Why don't you ask her yourself?
Can you put her on?
Put her on? Gertie said.
What do you mean?
Put her on the phone. Can I put her on the phone?
Gertie sounded baffled.
She's there with you, Teddy said,
wondering how they had achieved such a cross-purpose with each other.
No, she's not,
Gertie said.
She's not in Lyme Regis, with you, helping you move.
There was an awkward silence before Gertie said cautiously,
No, not here.
Teddy sensed that she was anxious that she might have betrayed Nancy in some way, and his first instinct, curiously, was to save Gertie from the flap she was getting into. So he said genially,
Oh, don't worry, I've got mixed up. I'll chase her down and get back to you.
The sideboard is a lovely offer, by the way. Thank you, Gertie. He got off the phone quickly, needing to review this odd information.
I'm going down to Lyme to give Gertie a hand with her house move.
It was hardly a statement that was open to misinterpretation. If there had been something that Nancy had not wanted him to know, something that had necessitated her pretending to be in Dorset with Gertie, then surely she must have a reason. He knew she could lie with grace when necessary, but Nancy was not furtive. In fact, quite the opposite. Sometimes he felt that the intimacy of their marriage had been based on her breaching the Official Secrets Act. When she returned from Dorset, he asked her nothing other than, How was the move? To which she replied,
Good. All went well.
Gertie's new house is nice, is it?
Very nice,
she said rather vaguely, and he left it at that, not wishing to seem as if he were interrogating her. Instead, he would wait and see if something developed from this omission. Adultery was not high on his list of suspects. He found it almost impossible to consider Nancy as the sort of wife who would hoodwink a husband. He had always thought of her, still thought of her, as irreproachable, scrupulous in both thinking and doing the right thing. Nancy was not the sort to feign innocence, but then nor was she the sort to misdirect. If she had lied to him, it must be a lie based on utilitarian principles. Perhaps there was a surprise hidden at the heart of this sleight of hand. A birthday treat? Or a family reunion? With Sylvie dead and Fox Corner sold, it seemed there was nothing left to shepherd the whole Todd family together any more. Teddy and his more stalwart siblings, Ursula and Pamela, never seemed to be together in the same place at the same time, except at funerals. No weddings. There didn't seem to be weddings any more. Why was that?
It's because we're between generations, Nancy said. It'll be Viola's turn, soon enough.
Viola was the solitary arrow they had shot blindly into the future, not knowing where she would land. They should have aimed better, Teddy thought, as he watched her, having sidestepped marriage to Dominic, the father of her children, finally tying the knot in Leeds Town Hall to Wilf Remain. A botched-up job of a marriage, if ever there was one.
He enjoys a drink, doesn't he?
Teddy said cautiously the first time Viola introduced him to my new man.
If that's a criticism, Viola said, and when have you ever done anything but find fault with me? You can go and shove it where the sun doesn't shine.
Oh, Viola. When Nancy left next, to meet up with Millie in the Lake District, Teddy vowed to himself not to check up on her like some tawdry private detective. No birthday treat or family reunion had revealed itself since her return from Dorset, but that was not proof of anything underhand. He resisted picking up the phone and calling Millie's flat to see if she was there, but his unease must have infected Viola, who spent the whole fretful time that Nancy was absent, nagging, "When is Mummy coming back?" He gave him a legitimate reason, he argued rather speciously with himself, for chasing up his discontented wife.
"Oh, hello there, Teddy," Millie drawled carelessly. "Haven't spoken to you in ages." "You're not in the lakes with Nancy, then?"
he said baldly, finding himself suddenly angry. Justifiably, surely. There were a couple of beats of silence before Millie said,
"Just got back. In fact, I've just seen her on the train home to you."
She was an actress, never so good on the stage as she was now, he thought. It made no sense that Nancy would have gone all the way down to Brighton before returning home, but he had no way of proving that this was what she had done, or not done. Teddy had never experienced jealousy before, he realized, as the tawdry private detective reared his ugly head and said,
"And so how were the lakes, Millie? What did you do, exactly?" "Oh, you know," she said easily. "Wordsworth Cottage and so on."
Did Millie not relate this conversation to Nancy? She certainly seemed blithely unaware that he had doubted her when she declared her intention to visit B. Were all of her sisters conspirators in deception, even good-hearted Gertie and solid matronly Winnie? Teddy felt not forbearance, but paralysis. He couldn't ask Nancy what was going on, the obvious thing to do, because the answer would either be a lie or a truth he didn't want to hear. So he plodded along. The words seemed to haunt him, although now he found everything sullied by suspicion. He brooded forensically on every nuance in Nancy's behaviour. There was, for example, something decidedly clandestine about discovering her in the hallway one evening, leaning against the anaglypta-papered wall, murmuring into the phone, and then cutting the conversation short when she caught sight of him.
"Who was that?"
he asked, as if it was a matter of indifferent interest to him.
"Just be. Just idle gossip," she said.
Or the way she was eager to be the first to pick up the post in the morning before she cycled off to school with Viola. Was she expecting something? No, not at all. He had come across her on more than one occasion wearing a preoccupied frown on her face, or staring into the middle distance when she was stirring a sauce or making a lesson plan.
"Sorry, miles away,"
or
"bit of a headache,"
she would say. She had become a victim of migraines in the past few months. Sometimes, too, he caught a fleeting expression of pain on her face when she looked at Viola. Torn between feelings for lover and child, he supposed. Betraying one's husband was bad enough, but to betray one's child was a different matter. He didn't believe that she was intending to visit either London or B. In his imagination, by now quite lurid, his scarlet wife was conducting her debauched trysts somewhere nearby, holed up perhaps in a sordid hotel on Micklegate. A wartime memory of his. A local girl. A regretfully dissipated encounter. After she had left to catch the train to King's Cross, he phoned Ursula and unburdened himself. But instead of sympathy, she was sharp and said,
"Don't be silly, Teddy. Nancy would never be unfaithful."
Et tu, Brute, he thought, for once disappointed in his sister. As planned, on Friday evening, his errant wife was brought promptly back from the station by a taxi. Teddy caught sight of it pulling up, and watched as Nancy paid and the taxi driver took her small case out of the boot. She looked weary as she walked up the gravel path to the house. Worn out by passion, probably, or distraught at having to leave her lover. He opened the door while she was still fumbling for her key.
"Oh, thanks," she said,
walking past him into the hall without looking at him. She reeked of tobacco and of alcohol, too.
"You've been smoking?" he said. "No, of course not."
Her lover must be a smoker, leaving his scent all over her, his spore.
"And drinking," he said,
feeling revulsion.
"Everyone was smoking in my carriage," she said dispassionately. "And yes, I had a whiskey on the train. Does it matter? Sorry, but I'm dog-tired."
"Must be all those museums and exhibitions," he said sarcastically.
"What?"
She put her case down and turned to stare at him, her expression unreadable.
"I know what's going on," he said.
"Do you?"
"You're having an affair. You're using all these little jaunts as cover."
"Jaunts?"
"You must think I really am slow to catch on. Poor old plodding Teddy."
"Plodding?"
"I know what you've been up to," he repeated,
growing irritable that she wasn't responding to his needling. If she confessed, declared that her affair was over, he would forgive her, he decided magnanimously. But if she continued to lie, he feared he might do or say something that there would be no going back from.
"I was never in love with you, you know."
It didn't help when she simply turned away from him and walked off into the kitchen, where she drew a glass of water from the tap. She drank it down slowly, and then placed the empty glass carefully on the draining board.
"I know,"
he said furiously, yet still trying to keep his voice low as Viola was asleep upstairs. Nancy looked at him sadly and said,
"No, Teddy, you don't know. You don't know anything."
1942-43. Teddy's War. Experience.
20 minutes to the run into the target, Skipper.
Okay, Navigator.
They had ploughed their way through the flak put up by the coastal defences, and dog-legged faithfully along the flight plan over occupied territory, before making it through the thick belt of searchlights that girdled the Ruhr. There had been very little cloud on the run-in, and they had occasionally been able to make out lights below, a factory at work, or a blackout not being strictly observed. More than once, torches or lamps had flashed up at them, and over Holland, Norman Best, their quiet flight engineer, had read out loud the Morse code from a well-wisher below. Dit, 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 da. V for victory. It was a message of both faith and comfort that they saw frequently.
"Thanks, pal, whoever you are,"
Teddy heard the rear gunner say. The rear gunner was a scrawny, red-headed Scot, 18 years old and the talkative sort, but he made an effort to keep his volubility for when they were on the ground. Teddy's crew knew that he favoured silence on the intercom unless there was something that needed saying. It was too easy to start chattering, especially on the way back when everyone was more relaxed. But even a moment's distraction, especially for the gunners, and that was it. End of the story. Teddy felt the same as his rear gunner did about the anonymous Dutchman, or woman, down there. It was good to know that they were appreciated up here. They were so cut off from the ground, even when they were destroying it with their bombs, especially when they were destroying it with their bombs, perhaps, that you could sometimes forget that there were entire nations for whom you were the last hope.
"I can see the target markers going down, Skipper. 20 miles ahead, cherry red." "Okay, bomb aimer."
It was the final op of their tour, and they were edgy with foreboding. They had beaten the odds to get to tonight, and were all wondering if fate could be so cruel as to bring them this far and then give them the chop. It could, they knew.
"Just one more, Jesus. Just one more,"
he had heard his godless Australian bomb aimer murmuring as they waited on the runway for the green Aldis light. It had been a terrific slog to reach the requisite 30. Some of their sorties only counted as a third of an op. Gardening runs, mine-laying in the Dutch shipping channels or off the Frisian coast, or attacking targets in France, only chalked up a third of an ob. Occupied France was considered a friendly country, but friendly or not, it was still full of Germans trying to shoot them down. It was true you were more likely to be killed on a raid over Germany. 4 times more likely, according to Ursula's girl at the Air Ministry, but you were still risking your life. It was rather iniquitous, Teddy thought. Or, in the more straightforward language of his bomb aimer, bloody unfair. Keith was the first person that Teddy crewed up with at the OTU. Crewing up was an unexpected affair that had taken them largely by surprise. All the components, pilots, navigators, wireless operators, bomb aimers and gunners, were simply emptied in a jumble into a hangar and told by the station commander, "Right, chaps, sort yourselves out best as you can," as if some mysterious law of attraction would form a better bomber crew than any military procedure. And, strangely, that seemed to be true, as far as Teddy could see, anyway. They had all milled about aimlessly for a while like a flock of geese in a farmyard at feeding time, somewhat abashed by what was being asked of them.
"It's like a bloody dance hall waiting to catch some girl's eye," Keith said, approaching Teddy and introducing himself. "Keith Marshall. I'm a bomb aimer."
His dark blue uniform marking him out as Australian. Teddy's first port of call had been a navigator, but he liked the look of Keith, and if the war was teaching Teddy anything, it was that you could often tell a man's character from the way he looked, an expression in the eyes, a glance here and there, but mostly something indefinable. And he wondered if it had been this elusive quality that it made him warm immediately to Keith. And the fact, of course, that he had overheard an instructor saying that he was a good bloke who knows his stuff. Turned out this was true. Keith may have washed out as a pilot.
Couldn't land the bloody thing.
But had graduated top of his class on his bombing course. Australians had a reputation for being rambunctious, but Keith seemed steady, his blue eyes thoughtful. He was 20, brought up on a sheep station, and had spent a good deal of his life, Teddy supposed, gazing at a distant horizon under a harsh sun, unlike the soft green fields of Teddy's own childhood. It must form your perception of life, he supposed. He was looking forward to seeing something of the world, Keith said,
even if it's only the Third Reich on fire.
They shook hands, like gentlemen, and Keith said,
"Well, Skipper, let's get a move on. We don't want to be left with just the wallflowers."
This was the first time, Teddy thought, that a member of his crew, had called him Skipper. He felt as though he had finally stepped into his own shoes. They scanned the hangar together, and Keith said,
"See that bloke over there by the wall, laughing at something? He's a wireless operator. I had a drink with him last night, and he seemed like a straight sort."
"Okay," Teddy said. It seemed as good a recommendation as any. The spark was a 19-year-old from Burnley called George Carr. Teddy had already witnessed George Carr offering to mend someone's bicycle, enthusiastically taking it to pieces and putting it back together again, before presenting it to its owner, saying,
"There, better than when it was new, I'll bet."
He liked fiddling with things, he said, which seemed a useful trait in a wireless operator. George, in turn, pointed out an air gunner for them, again an acquaintance based on a night drinking in the mess. He was called Vic Bennett, and he was from Canvey Island, and had a toothy grin. He had the worst teeth of anyone Teddy had ever seen. And after he was introduced, he hailed a mate who he'd been on his gunnery course with.
"Sharp as a tack," he said. "Reflexes of a rat. Looks a bit like one, too. A ginger rat."
This was their talkative young Scot.
"Kenneth Nielsen, but everyone calls me Kenny."
Still no navigator, Teddy thought, bemused at how quickly he'd lost any control of this process. It was a little like a game of consequences, or perhaps blind man's bluff. How do you tell a good navigator, he wondered, looking round the room? Someone unflappable, but then that was a quality they all needed, wasn't it? Nose to the table, focused on nothing but the job. From somewhere behind him, he heard the slow, imperturbable notes of a Canadian accent. He turned around and, identifying the owner of the voice, caught sight of his navigator's brevet and said,
"Ted Todd, I'm a pilot in the market for a good navigator."
"I'm good," the Canadian said with a shrug. "Good enough, anyway."
He was called Donald McClintock, Mac, naturally. Teddy liked Canadians. In his time over there, he had found them to be reliable and not given to neuroses or overactive imaginations, neither of which were good qualifications for a navigator. And just hearing the accent had brought back fond memories of the big open skies where he had learned to fly on tiger moths and fleet finches, fluttering above the great patchwork of Ontario. They were fragile little things compared to the Ansons and Harvards he had graduated onto, to say nothing of the hulking Wellingtons that they were going to be doing their training on at the OTU.
"Bus drivers," was how fighter pilots referred derisively to bomber pilots, but it had seemed to Teddy that it was going to be the buses that won the war.
"Welcome on board, navigator," Teddy said,
more gentlemanly handshaking all round. They were a mixed bag, all right, Teddy thought. He rather liked that.
"We just need a Kiwi for a flight engineer," Keith said, echoing his thoughts, "and it'll be like the bloody League of Nations."
They didn't get a Kiwi. They got Norman Best from Derby, a rather shy, earnest ex-grammar school boy with a degree in languages and a firm Christian faith, but not until they reached their heavy conversion unit, so that was that for now. They were a crew, just like that. From now on, they drank together, they ate together, they flew together, and their lives were in each other's pockets. That first night, after crewing up, they went on the obligatory crew binge. The egalitarian spirit meant that everyone must take their turn to buy a round. So, 6 pints later, they staggered back to their sleeping quarters as drunk as lords and declaring their undying friendship. Teddy had never been so inebriated in his life, and he realized as he lay on top of his bunk that night, the room revolving around him, that he had never been as elated either. Or at least not for a long time. Not since he was a boy, perhaps. He was about to have an adventure. They were all NCOs, apart from Teddy. He had been given a commission, for no other reason, as far as he could tell, than that he had been to the right school and the right university, and that, when asked, he had said that, yes, he liked cricket, which he didn't that much, actually, but he could see to say so would be the wrong answer. And that was why he was here now, months later, en route to Duisburg, a leader of men, the master of his fate, the captain of his soul, and of a bloody big four-engined Halifax with an unnerving tendency to swing to the right on takeoff and landing.
10 minutes to target, skipper.
Okay, navigator.
10 minutes to target, bomb aimer.
Okay, skipper.
In the air, they addressed each other by their roles, but on the ground they were defined by themselves. Ted, Norman, Keith, Mac, George, Vic, and Kenny. Like playmates in a storybook adventure, Teddy thought. Two of Augustus's pals were called Norman and George, but Izzy's Augustus and his cohorts were still 11 years old, forever young, and occupied with their catapults, with catching minnows and raiding the larder for jars of jam, which for some reason they seemed to regard as the holy grail of foodstuffs. Izzy's creation and his band of merry boys were currently doing their bit in Augustus and the War, scavenging for paper by taking the newspaper from people's letterboxes and collecting scrap metal for salvage by stealing pots and pans from the Swifts' outraged neighbours.
"The frying pan isn't scrap," an exasperated Mrs. Swift said.
"But it's for the war,"
Augustus protested.
"You're always saying we have to give up things. I'm giving up people's pans."
Izzy's Augustus, Teddy thought rather resentfully, didn't have to deal with flak or worry about a Messerschmitt descending on him like a hungry bird of prey. His own Augustus, his grown-up double, as he imagined him, was almost certainly dodging life in the services. He was probably a spiv,
a war profiteer, selling spirits and fags, and anything else he could get his mucky hands on.
There you go, Gov. That'll be 10 bob. Remember, mum's the word.
They were toiling through flak, continual shell flashes and oily grey puffs of smoke buffeting them, although the noise of the explosions was drowned out by the aircraft's own deafening Merlin engines.
"Keep a sharp lookout, everyone,"
Teddy said. In the distance, he could see a shower of incendiaries coming down, being jettisoned probably by an aircraft trying to gain more height. All it did was provide helpful illumination for the German fighters flying above the bomber stream, who were dropping marker flares, pretty like chandeliers, that seemed to hang in the air, providing a well-lit corridor for the unfortunate bomber to fly along. Seconds later, the bomber erupted into a blood-red fireball, belching black smoke.
"Log that, Navigator," Teddy said.
"Okay, Skipper."
They had taken off late. As an experienced crew, they would normally have been near the front of the bomber stream. But there had been trouble with the port inner engine, and they became the last, rather than the first, aircraft to take off from their station, and were right at the tail of the skein when they reached the rendezvous point over Flamborough Head.
"Well, someone has to bring up the rear,"
Teddy said, in a rather futile attempt to encourage his downhearted crew. They all knew that being a straggler made them an easier target for the fighters to pick off, a distinct little blip on the German radar, rather than part of a protective flock. A crowded bomber stream presented its own terrors, of course. Earlier in their tour, they had been part of Harris's first 1,000-bomber raid on Cologne. In a great armada like that, you found yourself wallowing in someone else's slipstream, wondering all the time where everyone else was. It had seemed to Teddy that the greatest danger came not from the German fighters or flak, but from their own side. They had been stacked in layers, the slow Stirlings at the bottom, the high-flying Lancs at the top, the Halifaxes providing the filling in the sandwich. The exact speed, height, and position for each aircraft was predetermined, but that didn't mean that everyone was where they were supposed to be. At one point on the route, another Halifax had passed right over the top of them, with only 20 or so feet clearance, a great dark shape like a whale, one with red-hot exhausts. And later, on the track to the target, Vic Bennett, in the mid-upper turret, had started yelling blue murder because there was a Lancaster above them that had just opened its bomb doors, and Teddy had to jink away from it, worrying that they in turn would slam into another aircraft. They had witnessed a collision too close for their own comfort, when a Halifax on their port beam crossed the bomber stream, and a Lancaster flew smack into it. Their own aircraft, J-Jig, before they lost her, was rocked by the massive explosion. Bright white sheets of flame shot up from the petrol tanks in the wings of the Lank, and Teddy shouted at his gunners not to look in case they lost their night vision. There had been no trouble finding Cologne. By the time they reached the target, it was ablaze. Filthy red flames and smoke everywhere that had already hidden the marker flares. So they headed for the centre of the largest fire, and dropped their bombs, and banked away. Looking back, despite the colossal size of the Enterprise, it seemed like an uneventful raid, and to tell the truth, Teddy could barely remember the details of it now. It felt as if he had lived many lifetimes, or perhaps just the one endless night that, according to Blake, some were born to. And time itself had a different quality. Before, it had been like a vast map, seemingly endless, that had been unrolled before him, and on which he could choose in which direction to go. Now the map only unrolled beneath his feet a step ahead at a time, and might at any moment disappear.
"I felt the same at the height of the attacks on London," Ursula said, attempting to decode this tortuous metaphor when he saw her on his first leave. They had 6 days off every 6 weeks, and he had chosen to spend them in London rather than Fox Corner. He didn't even tell Sylvie he had leave.
"Before the war," Ursula said, "every day was much the same, wasn't it?
Home, the office, home again. Routine dulls the senses so. And then suddenly it feels as if one's living on the forward edge of one's life, as if one never knows if one is about to fall or fly.
Neither extreme seemed to involve a soft landing, Teddy noticed.
I suppose so,
he agreed, realizing he had no real idea what he was talking about, and didn't much care. He lived his life in the face of death. It was a simple enough reduction, without hedging it around with figurative language.
8 minutes to target, Skipper.
Okay, Navigator.
Stay alert, Gunners.
Yes, Skipper.
Okay, Skip.
The Gunners didn't need reminding. It was just a way of keeping everyone in touch. He knew they were swinging their guns around the sky, ever vigilant. They had hardly fired their guns in the whole of the tour. As soon as you started shooting, you marked yourself as a target. A fighter could easily miss you in the dark. But if you were laying a thread of red tracer fire right to your door, he would soon find you. And his big cannons would do a lot more damage than their own puny Browning machine guns could. Gunners were, essentially, your lookouts. There were gunners who went through a whole tour without ever firing off a round. Teddy's sister, Pamela, was married to a doctor who told him that he had read some data about experiments in oxygen chambers, and that oxygen would help the gunner's eyesight, which was also the first thing that would go if they started to suffer from oxygen deprivation. After that, Teddy had started keeping his gunners on oxygen from takeoff to landing. They were in the thick of a heavily defended area. A grey curtain of smoke from the flak barrage lay dead ahead of them, a curtain of explosive that they had to get through. Compared to those big 1,000-bomber raids, tonight was a relatively modest one. Some 200 or so aircraft, 12 from their own squadron, all heading in their loose gaggle towards the Ruhr, the Happy Valley. They had seen a Lancaster go down, hit in the wing by a fighter, seen it turn into a falling leaf of fire, and they had seen, too, a fellow Halifax being coned as it came through the Ruhr's defences. It was caught in the blue master beam, and they watched without comment as the slave beams turned, like soulless automata, towards their prey, trapping it in blinding white light, and pumping their shells remorselessly up at it. The aircraft dived desperately into a corkscrew, but the beams were locked relentlessly on it, and the heavy flak must have found it, because they saw it explode in a great ball of flame.
"Log that, Navigator,"
Teddy said in a dispassionate voice.
"Did anyone see any parachutes?"
A murmuring of no's on the intercom.
"A poor bastard's,"
from Keith, settled flat out on his front in the nose of the aircraft, ready for the run in. It was always a shocking thing to see an aircraft going down, but there wasn't time to think about it. It wasn't you, that was the important thing. "If we go," Teddy prayed, "let us go instantly. The fireball, not the fall. There will be no soft landing, whichever way." He was fatalistic rather than morbid. The last thing his crew needed at the moment, at any moment, was a despondent captain. Especially tonight, when they were so jittery. They looked exhausted too, Teddy thought, a weariness that went beyond mere tiredness. What they looked was old, Teddy realized. And yet Keith had only just celebrated his 21st birthday, with a raucous party held in the sergeant's mess. There was an innocence in all their celebrations, like naughty boys at a noisy children's party. The sooty footprints on the ceiling, the unseemly lyrics of the sing-songs around the piano after the WAFs had decorously retired for the night, a bolder one or two sometimes remaining. Not so very different from Augustus and his little pals, after all. Sylvie, rather inclined to indolent timekeeping, kept the clocks at Fox Corner running 10 minutes ahead, a practice that tended to lead to confusion rather than punctuality. Teddy thought now how much better it would have been if someone had pushed their clock backward, if they had been led to think that this was their 29th sortie rather than their 30th, freeing them from their gloomy premonitions. To make matters worse, they had a second dickie on board. He was a novice pilot being blooded on his first trip. It was customary to send a tyro up with an experienced crew for a look-see before he took his own crew on operations. But for some reason a green second pilot was regarded as a jinx. There was no rhyme or reason to this belief, as far as Teddy could see. His own first blood was drawn on a flight to bomb the docks at Wilhelmshaven with C. Charlie, a crew on their 12th op, and they had barely acknowledged his existence, as if by ignoring him they could pretend he wasn't sitting there in the dicky seat. C. Charlie came back with hardly any damage, some holes from flak and one engine out. But even after they had landed, the crew still avoided him, as if he might taint them somehow. Unlike his own crew, who were overjoyed to have him back safe and sound on the earth. And they all went on a mighty crew binge at a local pub, ground crew included, to celebrate this fact. The Black Swan, known by everyone as the Mucky Duck, had a very accommodating landlord who let the air crews have running tabs, knowing that many of them would never be paid. The Dead Reckoning. On Teddy's second tour, there was a Sprog crew, W. William was their aircraft, who lost their pilot when he took his flight with another crew. They were immediately given a replacement, who duly took his dicky flight and also didn't come back. Perhaps they were bad luck, after all. The pilotless Sprog crew were beside themselves at this point, like anxious dogs. And so, when they were given a third, understandably nervous, pilot, Teddy took the whole crew up on their first op together, the new pilot in the dicky seat of W. William, his own aircraft. It was a testing, maximum effort raid to Berlin, and they more than held their nerve. When they landed, they were filled with jubilation.
"Well done, boys," he said.
They were boys, not one over 20. They invited him to have a drink with them in the sergeant's mess. He was, after all, part of their crew, they said. He went, but bowed out early.
"Discretion being the better part of valour," he wrote to Ursula, as it was one of her favourite aphorisms.
"Not always," she wrote back.
W. William was on the battle order next day, a relatively safe mine-laying trip to drop veg off Langerug in the East Frisians. Teddy felt more than usually sad when reading the familiar entry in the operations log the next day. This aircraft took off at 1620 hours and failed to return. It has, therefore, been reported as missing. He found it difficult after the war to look at the North Sea without thinking of it as one enormous watery graveyard, full of the rust and bones of aircraft and youthful bodies. On their next sortie, the crew of C. Charlie, who had so reluctantly taken Teddy as their second dicky, ran out of fuel looking for somewhere to land in fog, and crashed on the moors near Helmsley.
"They're 13th,
Vic Bennett said, as if that explained it. He was the most superstitious of all of them. When they flew their own 13th op to Stuttgart, on a Friday, no less, he asked the chaplain to put a special blessing on poor old J. Jig, which the chaplain, a jolly, obliging sort, did quite happily. The first 5 ops and the last 5 ops were believed by crews to be the most dangerous, although as far as Teddy could see, the laws of probability applied every time. Only 1 in 6 aircrew made it through their first tour. Never before or since, he thought, would so many be so obsessed with statistics. He hadn't needed Ursula's girl in the Air Ministry to tell him that the odds were stacked against them. At the beginning of this tour, if Teddy had been a gambling man, which he wasn't, he wouldn't have laid bets on them living to see their grandchildren. Or their children, for that matter, as they hadn't even reached that stage in their lives yet. None of them were married, and according to Teddy's reckoning, at least half of them had been virgins when he first met them. Were any of them now? He didn't know. Not Vic Bennett. He was engaged to a girl called Lillian,
Lil, who he never stopped talking about, including everything they got up to. Vic was getting married to Lillian next week. They were all invited. Teddy didn't think Vic should have made plans.